One of the most important things we do in higher ed is assessment. Yet it's probably also one of the least understood, especially among those outside of academia. Further complicating things is that assessment also falls under the umbrella of continuous improvement, which sounds pretty noble at face value, but it's also rather vague. In spite of all this, we assess our courses and programs on a regular basis in the Engler College of Business, always trying to bring about improvements. Today, we'll put a forward face on this vitally important activity. Roll the intro.
You're listening to Buff Speak, the official podcast of the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. I am Dr. Nick Gerlich, your host, as we meet up with the thought leaders making an impact today.
My guest today is Dr. Neil Meredith, Director of Continuous Improvement, Professor of Economics, and the Dana Professor of Business. Welcome back to the show, Neil. You've been here before, but in different contexts. It's great to have you back.
Good to be back, Nick.
Before we dive into all things assessment, though, let's talk about important things. Let's talk about you, okay? and your background here. And so just tell us who you are, where you're from, and how you got here.
Sure. So try to give you the short version. As I get older and older, it's like you want to just get straight to the point. So the elevator pitch. So the economics bug kind of caught me as an undergraduate student. I originally started out as a math education major, but that didn't work out. I knew I still wanted to teach, though. And I, at the time, was thinking, well, I think I want to go on to a graduate degree. And if I want to teach in this economics stuff that I'm really enjoying at the time, plus use some of this math that I seem to have a knack for, then let's make that transition. And so bada bing, bada boom, I went and got my PhD at the University of Georgia. Go Dogs. I'm originally from Eastern Pennsylvania, not too far from the Hershey, Pennsylvania area, the so-called sweetest place on earth. And I have been here at WT since 2011. So now it's 15 years. I've already been out here in the Texas Panhandle. Love it being here.
And where did you go to school before Georgia?
I went to IUP, Indiana University of Pennsylvania, and some of the folks out there might actually recognize it because this year's college championship team at Indiana, which you would know something about Nick, coach used to be the head coach at IUP, actually, along his trajectory there.
And how and why did you pick Georgia for your PhD program?
You know, I wanted to get away from the Pennsylvania winners. And, you know, at the time, I probably should have had a you live and you learn and you hope you would have a better understanding of the different rigors of different academic programs and things like that. But I knew I wanted to go someplace where it was warmer. And, you know, so I applied to a whole bunch of different Southeastern schools. But I also, you know, threw in like Southern Methodist and some other schools in there in the mix. And of all the schools that I applied to, the University of Georgia, I think, had the best reputation and gave me a good acceptance and a, you know, financial assistance package. So I was like, okay, let's go.
So what was life like in Athens, Georgia? That is one of the quintessential college towns. Mm-hmm. I've visited several times. I love it there. I almost wound up going there for a second master's, but that just didn't happen. Bloomington kept
sure.
me. And
sure.
That's another great college town. But I can only imagine what it was like going to school there in Athens. They got a little music there.
Yeah, they
do.
Some pretty
great bands.
So REM got its start there. One concert I went to. Now, I wasn't super into the music scene. That's just me. But one concert I did go to there, Owl City, was on tour at that point. And I don't know if Carly Rae Jepsen was there with them or not. That was not too long after they had done their, right around the time that they had done their collaboration with It's Always a Good Time or something like that around that time and those kinds of things. But I definitely remember, it's still on my playlist to this day on Spotify, you know, the Fireflies song and stuff like that. I definitely remember the lead singer there going and singing about it, but he was also like really into Chick-fil-A. He's just every once in a while in the refrain or something, he's like, yeah, Chick-fil-A, like something like that. But, you know, I mean, it had a great scene for, you know, lots of little bars and music and things of that sort. It's interesting place to go to school. I really loved the football aspect of things because I'm a sports fan. I'm a sports guy in my free time. And so it was just awesome to be able to go to some of the games while I was there because you have 90 some thousand people there in the stadium. It's a whole thing. It's like it shuts the town down, kind of. People everywhere, all over campus. And some of the best football games of my life I've been to. And Matt Stafford was actually the quarterback for the years that I was there. And he, you know, just recently had his MVP season out there with the team out there in LA. So very, very spoiled, very, very blessed to have gone to school there while I did. And so I tried to make the most of it.
Was Athens one of those kinds of college towns where they warned the grad students, be careful or you might fall in love with Athens and never want to leave?
Yeah, I mean, you know, there definitely is an aspect of, you know, you've got to be careful that you don't get too out of your studies and things like that. I was a pretty serious student. So it was like, you know, it's summertime. I'm studying for my qualifiers. So I'm studying for my qualifiers, my prelims, and I'm super locked in and religiously, you know, studying all my stuff, you know, 6 days a week and really getting after it. So, you know, maybe I could have spent a little more time playing, but I think I did enough of that sort of stuff, trying to balance things out, so to speak.
So we skip forward 15 years. Here you are, full professor. You've been through all the trials and tribulations of promotion and tenure and all that fun stuff. And
oh, yeah.
What do you like to teach?
So my bread and butter course that I love to teach online is my health economics class. So especially for our graduate students, we have a lot of grad students who have worked in the medical field. They'll either be, you know, DOs, MDs. We have some PharmDs and other medical related professionals, some pharmacists and those kinds of things. You know, they want more training on the business side of things. And so they come and they take our MBA healthcare program with us. And it really gives them a good sense of just the business side of things, which, you know, you don't necessarily get that, or you're probably not going to get that as you just, you know, come through, say, traditional medical school or something like that. And it's like, there's a whole business side of things in medicine. People want to come back and they want to learn more about that. And the health economics course then digs into policy and what's really going on in the healthcare system, because there's so much noise and there can be so many different people speaking from so many different places that you have a hard time then understanding or recognizing what's actually accurate and true. And so what I actually try to do in the class is try to give an accurate, true picture to the best of my ability based on research and data and taking a really hard look at what's really going on with the U.S. healthcare system or the U.S. healthcare system compared to others in the world. How do we apply supply and demand in that sort of framework? And what's different about medical care versus, say, other places where you might apply markets? And so I really enjoy that class in the graduate curriculum. And now in the undergraduate curriculum, I really do love teaching principles of economics because I just love to open up the world of economics to people that have never, you know, really thought about, okay, well, what about incentives? Like, what is that? How does that matter? How does that drive behavior? What about the supply and demand thing I hear about, prices and, you know, fads or whatever that might feed into different things that people do related to, you know, the economy or whatever, right? And so I love that aspect of, especially on campus, of making that personal connection and hoping to open people's eyes to a different way of looking at things.
Well, I think everybody has at least a basic knowledge of what supply and demand is, because we see it every day in our consuming ways when we're shopping and doing those kinds of activities. But we never saw it in terms of a graph, where there's a demand curve going this way and a supply curve going that way. And then we can get really complicated and start throwing in marginal revenues and, you know, all these other different curves and lines and so forth. And the average person doesn't get any of that. They don't think like that. They're not thinking in the store like, well, you know.
Right, right. And I mean, look, in the long term of things, I don't have an expectations that students in the long term would remember all that marginal revenue, marginal cost stuff, unless, you know, you're looking to go on and get a PhD in economics or some, you know, related field, public policy or something like that, where it might be very much of use to you to, you know, have familiarity with those models, because you might teach classes like that at some point, right? But really, the more important thing, I think, is, you know, some of the program goals and objectives that we set as we talk about the assessment process like we're going to do today. You might have a big program objective of, you know, instilling critical thinking. And so, yes, the economics material is just it's a vehicle for doing that. But it does that in a way that, you know, is unique and I think is a strength of economics, is that we teach this really deep, systematic, analytical approach to just looking at and analyzing anything that you might run into or make decisions with. And that it is that bigger, deeper analytical approach and principles of that's what you carry with you. It's not necessarily I remembered how to, you know, dot all the I's and cross all the T's.
I like to think a lot of our current socio-political angst could be resolved if everybody just took more economics courses. In an ideal world, the ideal world of Dr. Neil Meredith, how many econ classes should everybody have to take that they could be at least conversational?
Right. You know, so I think to the credit of the state of Texas, you know, I think they have certain requirements. I'd have to familiarize myself with K-12 you know, requirements for public schools and things like that to know for sure. But my perception, though, based on the students that we have come in here and who have, you know, have some background already in some economics, the state is already doing that to some extent. You know, I think everybody would benefit from having the principles behind them, but I get that not everyone has that luxury of time to, you know, in effort to do all of that. And that's okay. You don't necessarily need to know all the ins and outs of markets if, you know, you're like, look, I'm working here and I'm going to be welding a whole lot of heavy steel. That's what I'm going to do for my career. Maybe you're involved in working on a lot of railroad cars and working on heavy steel. Like we have a lot of, we have a major, you know, railroad, commercial railroad network with BNSF up in Amarillo, right? And they've probably got people there working on the rail cars and things like that. They don't necessarily need to know that to be doing their job and do what they do day in and day out. But at the same time, I think just it helps everybody when it comes to being in the voting booth, right? It helps if you have some background, some know-how to know, okay, well, is that credible? Is that true? Is it not? Like, who's telling the truth? Who's not? Who's just telling big-time lies? Who's telling small lies and things of that kind of sort? It can help you to sort that kind of stuff out.
In a nutshell, what are some of your research interests?
Healthcare. right now I'm working on, as I have time, but I haven't had as much time lately. I am working on projects that use methods from causal inference. So the way I would describe causal inference is that, you know, we have to be really careful about trying to determine a causal relationship between two variables or two measures. So if I want to say that, drinking water causes my body to physically perform better, right? We can perhaps be really careful about the causality and we can look at that in some sort of laboratory or something like that. In economics, it can be really tricky with causality because you might want to look at two economic variables, but it's really hard to, for example, think about the relationship between, say, unemployment and crime. Does more crime result in more unemployment, or does more unemployment result in more crime, right? So you've got this two-way kind of thing. And then it can be really hard to figure out really what the causal relationship is between those two because of those things. And so it's not just enough to just collect a little bit of data and throw together a basic regression. You've got to take a more in-depth approach which is one thing we do now is we start looking around for, and we're even talking about this now in Principles of Microeconomics, which I think is great. It's come to the, but you might have some listeners out there that maybe took courses years ago and they have not heard of natural experiments, as I will call them. But a natural experiment is basically, it's something where you have a situation where you have a control group and an experiment group by accident. So for example, different states pass different laws for different policies. So one thing I'm working on right now has to do with vaccine policy and exemption policies that vary by state. So it turns out in 2014 in Disneyland, there was a measles outbreak, predating even, you know, measles outbreaks going on right now. And the state basically said, okay, we're done. We've had it. We're just going to, you know, we're only going to have medical exemptions for vaccine policy. So if you enter kindergarten in California from 2016 forward and you're not up to date on your shots, you better have a medical exemption. Otherwise, you say if you come with a conscientious objection, a religious objection, or something else, they're just going to say, no, you can't enroll here until you get your shots. And so that's a more stringent policy. And other states have gone different ways or whatever. But you can use these different policies to create an experiment group and a control group kind of by accident, because California did this thing, but like Nevada did not, right? And Nevada and California are in a lot of ways really similar. Now they're different too, but they're still, you know, two US states, and there's a lot of similarities there. So you can, you know, say, okay, we're going to just keep looking at Nevada as our control group that didn't have anything happen there. And then you've got California where you actually did have something change, and you can compare those two before and after the change. And that way you can sort of by accident get your experiment and control group as your natural experiment thing. So you have a little bit of training to look for those things. We can get better at looking at that kind of stuff, and then we can use methods to help tease out the causality with that.
I think it's great when some of your research interests are parallel with your teaching interests, because on one hand, you can be creating knowledge, and on the other hand, disseminating it. That's a sweet spot to be in.
Yes. Especially, I try to research topics that I think would be interesting to somebody sitting around at a dinner party, right? I'm not the kind of researcher. Now, there are other researchers. I respect them for what they're doing and whatnot. They're moving fields along in other ways. But there are researchers who they'll work on some sort of super technical thing that only people who are in the field are really going to be able to wrap their heads around and, you know, do or whatever, and it advances the field and fine. But I like to work on topics where I could sit around the dinner table and I can, you know, I can back away the jargon and I can say, here's the research that I've done and here's why I think it actually matters.
And how long have you been director of continuous improvement now?
I'm now a little over a year into it, so 14 months.
So you're still learning some aspects of it, but others
yes.
You've kind of figured out by now,
yes.
I imagine, right?
Yes.
Well, so here we have the director of continuous improvement. Here is an economist and a self-professed math nerd. I can't think of a better combination of traits to have in that office, because basically you're dealing with a lot of data.
Yes. So, I mean, the key aspect of one of the key aspects of assessment is you've got to get data. And when you are looking to assess programs, like say the MBA program, and see how things are going in the program, then you need program level data, right? Just as if I'm teaching a class and I want to assess and see what a student's performance is in the class, I need their performance data for that class. So I need the right data for the right purpose. And so, having the background of just knowing like, okay, we're looking for this data and we're wanting this data because we hope that or it should be driving some decision-making that happens, especially concerning curriculum and other things. You need program-level data. You need to take this serious, systematic approach to this so that you can get those better answers so that you can then hopefully make changes to make improvements.
How and what we do in assessment is the big question. That's up after the break.
Life sometimes has a way of interfering with our university education. Marriage, family, work, any or all of these can cause us to hit the pause button on our degree, with hopes of one day finishing it. The only problem is that returning to campus can get a lot harder when you're no longer 20 years old. And that's precisely why we launched our online BBA, with majors in accounting, finance, general business, marketing, management, human resource management, and computer information systems. Available completely online. You can return to school without having to step foot on campus. Or maybe you want to transfer in from a two-year program elsewhere, but once again, are not able to attend face-to-face. Our online offerings are for you as well. We can help you finish your degree and climb higher on your career ladder, at your pace and in your time. We're AACSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WTBBA in hand. For more info, find us at wtnu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2525.
I was part of the original efforts to build an assessment program more than 15 years ago, before the College of Business was accredited by AACSB. And, well, as you might expect, we knew we had to do it, but we really didn't know much about how to do it. And that was always challenging there, because basically a lot of our early efforts were hit and miss, but they provided us with a valuable foundation from which we could build, and we have built. It's been more than 15 years now that we have been assessing all that we do, and now we have a full-time director of continuous improvement. We didn't see that coming back around 2009. So tell us, Neil, exactly what is this whole continuous improvement idea, and what's the underlying philosophy?
Essentially, you're just trying to get better. You're just trying to get better at improving learning. That's really what it is about, really improving learning in a real and substantive and significant way. And so, you know, you may do things like you go and you collect data. You may collect data that's you directly tie to some different outcomes, but you also might get some different surveys that you collect data from to see how people feel about programs. So there's both direct and indirect assessment that we do to just try to improve learning and improve our programs and our process.
So you could look at this from two different ways. Does it mean that we're never good enough, or does it mean we can always do it better?
You know, I don't like to think of it as like we're never good enough. I like to think of it as like nobody is perfect. And so there's always something more to learn about how we could be taking our approach with our programs to instill the skills that we want to. And then also, you know, things change as time moves on, right? And so, you know, the real big buzz is everything going on with artificial intelligence, right? And everyone's scrambling, trying to figure out what's the best way to manage this so that we can hopefully put ourselves in a position where we're getting a lot of net positives from this new tool. And we're, you know, able to reduce the risks from it.
And how does assessment play a role in all of this? I mean, what is assessment? How you do it? And how does it relate to like our objectives in the college and so forth?
So I like to think of it as it's a systematic and purposeful approach to collecting data on how we are actually doing with building towards certain objectives and then goals that we say that we have for the program, right? So an objective is something that, now this is just how our accreditor defines it. People sometimes use the words goals and objectives interchangeably, so I'm not wanting to cause any confusion for the audience out there, anyone who's listening to this, but this is how AACSB says how we define an objective. an objective is more something I can directly evaluate right now before you graduate, right? So I can say, okay, I have an objective of, you know, you're going to have a really solid grounding in all the different areas of business in our BBA program. So we can go and we can say, all right, how well are you doing with the fundamentals of accounting? And we can, you know, run some different test questions and we can get some data back from that and we can get a sense of it, right? Whereas our goals are things that we hope that you are able to meet for the future over the course of like your career, right? And so we might have a goal of like, hey, we really want you to be a really great communicator. And so we can then ask you after you've been out of the program, right? We could use an alumni survey or something like that. And we could say, all right, how do you feel about how well you can communicate in your job and those kinds of things? And so the assessment process is, it's not just some random thing. It's not just something that we do just because we have to for accreditation. It's a thing that's really designed to really deeply ask ourselves, how can we improve this program? How can we continually be trying to do things, perhaps in a different way, or in all sorts of different ways and whatnot, so that we can get better?
One of the ways that we do it is actually the same way I started out doing it many years ago for the principles of marketing class. It was basically the agreement between everybody teaching that principles class that we would all have the same comprehensive final exam. It was a multiple choice exam. It was timed at an hour. We had a test bank of sometimes many hundreds of questions, but we would agree to pull like 50 questions so that the exam length was the same for everybody. The questions might have differed. At one time or another, we migrated to just having the same test for everybody, one size fits all. And then we did a bunch of number crunching and item analysis, and we could find out where the students were good, where they were bad, if there were differences between face-to-face and online courses. I mean, we looked at the data from pretty much every side of the intersection, basically. Right. It's like eyewitness accounts of an accident downtown. You got witnesses on four corners. They're all going to tell a slightly different story because they saw it from a different angle, and we tried to do that. Do you see assessment as somewhat like that today?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're still trying to collect data from all sorts of different vantage points. And, you know, we're looking to meet the different goals and objectives. And also, we're looking to, I think, in a bigger picture sense, see, okay, what of our curriculum might need to change based on the assessment data that we have, right? Maybe there's certain courses, certain objectives for certain courses that need to be, you know, altered, or maybe there's a different course that needs to go in the program somewhere or something like that. Maybe there's a different option we need to offer. Maybe, for example, with the artificial intelligence stuff, right? Like, how are we going to incorporate that? Because, you know, we have to acknowledge that reality of this thing is here and people are using it for, you know, all sorts of stuff in the business world. And so I think we need to try and familiarize our students with that in a real and significant way so that they can be better prepared to enter the marketplace when they get out there.
How often do we have to do assessment in a particular course?
You know, that varies. So as I've learned from my first year, there's, you know, ongoing rotations of different, when we pull data for different stuff. So sometimes we're pulling data, for example, for the fundamentals in our BBA program. We're pulling data for that like every year. So we are pulling data to see how people are doing in the principles of marketing, principles of management, principles of economics, principles of accounting, intro to business law, things like that, right? We're pulling data that every year to see how those fundamentals are getting across. The other programs, the master's programs, can all be a little nuanced in their own way, shape, and form because they're all they all have sort of their own little different hodgepodge of things. But, you know, there's generally common theme of communication, which is really common in AACSB business schools. That's something we really want to make sure is carried across.
Yeah. But is it safe to say that you don't have to assess everything every spring, summer, and fall?
No, you don't have to assess everything every year, but you've got to be able to. So AACSB likes us to build a table. I think they call it table 5.1 that they look for. In the when we fill out our assessment, our reaccreditation paperwork and our forms and those kinds of things, where they're looking to see that we are, you know, making that we are definitely looking to evaluate these objectives that we say that we care about across the curriculum. It's not just one course and it's not just one year, but it's a bunch of different years, different courses and whatnot. Not that you have to evaluate every single course every single year, but you've got some sort of rotation where you look at this table and you can say to yourself, all right, you looked at and you measured, you know, this objective that has to do with communication. You looked at it in not only in this course, but in this course and this course and this course and this course. And you looked at all this stuff across the board and you looked at all the data that came in from that so that you could get a more program level. How are things going across the entire program for communication for the MBA program, let's say?
So some classes, especially undergraduate principals classes, I can imagine most assessments being objective exams, multiple choice and so forth. But in other classes, especially the graduate ones, I think you're probably going to have a lot more subjectivity. And so you're going to have like written examples of work or may even be oral.
Right.
Communication.
Right.
And so is that rubric based then? Or,
yes.
Or what?
So we have, we've developed our own rubrics that go with our objectives. And when somebody, for example, has, let's say they have a paper, right? They collect the paper assignments from the students. Those students' submissions and the instructions will then say, go to me, the assessment director. I will then put them in our assessment repository, and then I will get a random sample of 20 students. Now, if there's fewer than 20 students in the class, I'll just use everything that was submitted. And then I'll get two faculty volunteers who are colleagues, let's say, and let's say it was my paper, it was my assignment, my class. So I'll get two of the other economists to go through, and they will use the rubric, and they will go through, and they'll say, okay, you're this student number one was exemplary on this rubric criteria. They were good on this rubric criteria, but they're not so great on the last rubric criteria. So it's almost like they're grading it, but they're not grading it. I mean, because you're just, it's not for a grade for the student, but it is to get a sense of how well did this student do with meeting this program objective.
Is it safe to say that you really are measuring knowledge, or are we measuring something else?
I mean, you know, we're trying to measure learning, right? And so, yeah, I mean, you could say how much learning do you think actually happened here? You could, you know, look at numbers and you could say, oh, your numbers are not so great. Doesn't look like there's much learning going on here. But then you could also say, well, okay, but our standards are very high. And so you have to then take in, you know, relevant feedback from my colleagues and others who do, you know, teach these courses and those kinds of things. I have to rely on their expertise and their opinions about, okay, well, what do you think explains part of this outcome and those kinds of things? And we can have that discussion. The important part is that we are having the discussion. The important part is that we are going through this process that's more than just, you know, off the top of my head, something that I just, you know, came up with on a whim, right? This process has been set up by, you know, top business schools throughout the entire world. And it's more than just casually getting together and casually throwing something together. This has been very carefully thought out and laid out. And you can go through the entire history of AACSB if you really want to. I mean, ChatGPT or whatever can take you there, but you can also go to AACSB's website and you can read through all of that. This is more than a casual process. Now, I'm not going to say it's as it's as nitty-gritty as a peer-reviewed journal process could be, especially for super high-ranking journals, right? And I don't think that the accreditation process, and I don't think the accreditors would say that they're looking to build it to be at that standard. But it is definitely a significant standard. And, you know, for a business school to go through and attain AACSB accreditation is basically saying, okay, we are going through a peer review. It may not be quite as rigorous as this high quality peer reviewed journal or whatever standard, but it's still a pretty significant, substantial standard to the point that, you know, Harvard's business school has AACSB accreditation, right? You can go check me on that, but I'm pretty sure that they do. You know, there's lots of top business schools in the world have the accreditation. But I want to say it's only a small portion of business schools that have the accreditation. It's not casual, this process. It's something to look at and say, okay, that's significant. You've actually done something.
To your point, though, about randomly selecting people, basically what you're saying is that this is a lot like quality control at any manufacturing concern. They don't test every widget coming off the line. They do a sample.
That's right.
And if the sample is good, then the conclusion is the population is good.
Right.
Because Otherwise, to look at every one, however many hundreds of students we have, 1,800 or so, would take a year.
It would take way too long. So we have to... We have to try to, you know, be judicious about doing enough so that we have done our job well enough so that we can, you know, say with confidence we're doing what we need to be doing to try to improve and get better with our programs.
And I must address the elephant in the room, and that, of course, is AI. With objective tests, we all know, unless we lock down browsers and activate the camera so we can watch what they're doing, students might be cheating using AI to take a quick screenshot or a phone pic of a test question and run it through an AI agent. Mm-hmm. They may be wearing Meta Ray-Ban glasses with cameras on either side of the frame and being able to just look at something and get an answer back. Or in the case of a written exercise, we all know it's not that hard to get a little help from Gemini or ChatGPT or, you know, take your pick, and you've got a professional grade paper there.
Right.
How do we get around that problem?
Sure. So I think, you know, we need to use the tools judiciously to try and push back. I mean, I'm for artificial intelligence and using it as much as we can throughout the program. I'm actually a fan because, I mean, I use it myself for doing various things, right? At the same time, if we really want to incentivize and ensure people are actually going through this is coming from a really great TED Talk I listened to on the subject. The productive struggle in your own mind of actually really learning something and really, you know, gravitating onto that and really, you know, then building up your knowledge level and building up your skills and things like that. It's more than just some trivial or trivia exercise. Then, you know, we have to try to find ways to just be wise and judicious about this. So what that looks like is saying, look, in all other parts of this class, for example, I'm going to encourage your usage of AI, with the exception of you can't take your exams with AI assistance. So we're going to turn on the web camera, we're going to turn on the screen monitoring, and now I put in a request and the Respondus folks have honored it. They're beta testing using a second camera from your phone. Which it should be pretty reliable, which then takes in even more of your environment so that you at that point can think like, okay, it's almost like you're being proctored in like a computer lab that just doesn't have internet access and stuff like that, right? And we're doing that not to be punitive or mean or accusatory of the students or something of that sort, but we're doing it because we've got to incentivize you to try to learn. Because trying to learn and building things up in your own mind then builds you to a place where you can ask better questions and have better things that you can do with an artificial intelligence tool, right? I think the way forward is partnering with AI. It's not with AI replacing human beings. I'm not saying that to say that there aren't some situations where there might be some jobs that do get replaced by AI, but I don't think it's going to be the vast majority. I like to think of the AI stuff almost like when ATMs or other technologies have come along. I just use the ATM as an example, or computers have come along, or whatever. Human beings haven't been completely replaced. Right? We're still there asking the questions. We're still there doing the guidance. We're still there making the decisions and those kinds of things. And so the tool is there to help with that kind of stuff.
When we come back, we'll talk about how we use the findings.
The MBA is the most popular graduate degree in the United States, and with good reason. It leads to better jobs, promotions, and salary increases. At the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, our MBA program is entirely online for when you're ready to make that move. With as few as 31 credit hours and specializations offered in 5 areas, you can fast-track your career in as little as 18 months. Whether you're looking for a promotion or initial job placement, you'll stand head and shoulders above the competition. And because we've been teaching online since 1997, we're not the new kids on the block. Trust your education and career to dedicated faculty who are not only experts in their fields, but also old pros in the online arena. Our consistently high rankings say it all. A GMAT waiver is available. We're AA CSB accredited and among the most elite of business schools around the world. Reach for the stars and do it with a WT MBA in hand. For more information, find us at wtamu.edu/COB or call 806-651-2500. From the Texas Panhandle to the world, we're here to help you reach those stars.
It's one thing to collect a bunch of data, but quite another to analyze it and then take action based on the findings. Neil, what do you do with all the data? What types of analyses do you do? What are you looking for?
Right. So historically, there's been, you know, a lot of analysis we might build through, say, pivot tables and those kinds of things. One of our biggest assessment activities we do is we have a capstone exam in our management 4315 class that's in our BBA program. We get a lot of data from that, and we try to see what's going on in there from year to year. We can look at it by major and those kinds of things, and then we can disclose that data and report some parts of it to our different folks across the college, and then those different disciplines can look at the data and the analysis, and they could say, okay, here's where we think things are going, here's where we don't. We can also sometimes, for example, this past year, it looks like as I've turned on the web camera as part of the artificial intelligence world that we're living in now, we've got to turn on the web camera so that we can incentivize people to, you know, be more honest with their work and at least get the risk down related to AI usage with those tools. When I've turned that on, the scores have come down on average, noticeably from where they were, say, a year or two ago. So it looks like when we take away the AI assistance, we're seeing, okay, how much have you actually learned and mastered in your own mind? And okay, we've got more work to do here than perhaps we thought we did. But that is an example of assessment working and doing what it's supposed to be doing, which is we're getting this data across the program, and now we can look at that. And again, it's preliminary at this point. I still need to get another semester of data, and I'll go through a super deep analysis and whatnot with that, like happens every year. But we can then look at that and say, okay, now we can see that maybe this happened across the board, that it's not just overall, but it's also by major. It's also, for the various disciplines and things like that, that all sorts of different ways we could look at this data. Everything's kind of down across the board. And okay, these scores were getting inflated from artificial intelligence. And so now we've got to do things to try and, bring the risk down from that. So if turning that web camera on and then turning on the phone now too, with a second camera in the room, is going to help incentivize a more honest outcome, then that's the way we need to be going.
How do you make comparisons? And I guess for that matter, how granular do you go? Are you comparing individuals? Are you comparing professors? Or are we just looking at the macro data for a course or a program?
You know, we really are looking at the program, right? The original data collection does come in from the professor level and things like that. So if someone's, I think, really curious, we can do those kinds of things. But we really do try to combine everything together as a program because we want to see what's going on for the entire program and not just one professor. Because that one professor has... they've been through their class. They've already seen their particular data for their one class that they're teaching, right? And they've perhaps seen the outcomes from their assessment data as they turn it in, right? So they can already see what that looks like for them, but they might be then interested to see what's going on program wide. If things are not going so well program wide for principles of microeconomics, okay. How then we as colleagues can sit there and say, all right, we're not meeting this particular objective. Is it because the way the objective questions are worded in this multiple choice test? Is that what it is? Do we need to update it and change the language a little bit? Or is it something more, we need to try and find different ways to get students to learn the material and really grasp and take onto it? And are there some different new approaches that we could take, for example, using artificial intelligence, that we think could enhance the learning process?
Do you look at any specific courses longitudinally?
Mm-hmm. Management 4315 is our capstone, so we look at that. The comprehensive exam from that, we get that longitudinally. We've got data for years,
and yet it's still kind of hard at times to make an apples to apples comparison because the curriculum changes. I mean, we're going to be talking about AI now, but 10 years ago, we didn't know what it was.
Right.
5 years ago, we didn't know what it was.
Right.
Just like in marketing, we were hardly even talking about e-commerce, even in 2009, even we should have been, but we weren't yet. And now it's got its own chapter in the textbook. Social media marketing has its own chapter. So things have changed. The subjects have changed. And other topics have kind of faded into the rear view. They're not getting as much attention as they once did. And so in my mind, that can make it harder to make very long sweeping comparisons because we're not comparing the same animal anymore.
Sure. So, you have to be careful about that. More often than not, at least in the things that I've seen, we're looking at, say, five-year comparisons or, an accreditation cycle for AACSB now lasts 6 years. And so we're looking perhaps at the current accreditation cycle that we're in, and we're not going and looking, 20 years in the past, because looking 20 years in the past just doesn't make any sense to us. There's just been so many things that have changed in 20 years. That why would you do that? Because again, apples, it's not apples to apples anymore. There's just so many different things that that can change, and those changes can creep up on you. We do the best we can to manage and keep up with that.
So what about all the different majors that the students are enrolled in? Are you investigating to see where the most learning is going on in which major, or are we just lumping them all together?
At least as much as we can from the different data that we have come in, we can get a look at what the data comes back for a particular major in terms of questions that are on the Management 4315 exam, for instance, right? But even though the data might look good, does that mean that the learning actually took place? And that's always does that mean that learning has actually really gotten better? Maybe the standards got pulled down lower, right? it's really hard to really, you have to then make that case. You have to then make the case of, no, the learning actually really did happen, and here's why. And you have to go and talk with your colleagues, and you have to talk with, you know, senior members of the faculty in various disciplines to get a sense of, is the learning really taking place there? Is there really development and stuff going on, or is it not? Now, one thing, you know, more recently that that the college has had going on is we have had a really good program through Coursera that has been used a lot in a lot of different courses throughout the college. And what was really confirming, or what was a really good thing that came from that, or that's been coming from that Coursera experience, is that there was a lot of stuff that people were already teaching and, you know, examining for, or, you know, assessing in their own classes, that Coursera was also doing the same thing. So they were literally this Coursera thing that top companies are using, that they're using to actually teach their own folks, you know, skills on, say, Tableau or something like that. And we're already in the program elsewhere, already doing that same thing, right? So now we're getting some confirmation of the sorts of activities that we're doing in this program are externally through Coursera and through these top companies getting confirmation of, yeah, what we're doing actually really matters in a significant way. I don't want to overstate it, but at the same time, we're not just you know, spinning wheels. We're actually really doing something significant with helping to develop skills and knowledge for people.
One of the things that always bothers me in the back of my mind is that with these objective tests, we don't necessarily have any proof that they have reliability or validity inherent in them. And yet we're using them to make big conclusions.
Sure. I mean, I think it's fair to ask the question of, you know, what's the relevant alternative, right? And I mean, it's a fair question to ask, though, of is this thing actually really getting fundamentally, key question I constantly ask in assessment is this actually really improving the outcome? Is this actually really improving the learning? I mean, at its most fundamental, is it actually that, or are we just spinning wheels? And, you know, I think that AACSB, the process we're going through and those kinds of things, it's not spinning wheels. We are actually going through something to actually do something of substance.
In your short term as Director of Continuous Improvement, what are some of the most significant findings that you've discovered?
Wow. Okay. Well, I've only been at this for a little over a year. So the person who preceded me had more than 5 years of experience at it. So I think she might have a better response than me. One thing was that I think we have to be careful about the interpretation of numbers we get back. Because the numbers might come back and, you know, we'll say, oh, we were looking to meet an 80% threshold, and we did. And then you look at that and you say, okay, but did the learning and improvement actually really happen? Or are the standards too low? Maybe we need to raise our standards in response. Maybe we need to make the questions harder or something like that. It's not as simple as just saying, well, we met the threshold, therefore everything's all hunky-dory. Maybe there's something more going on there, and we need to at least ask that question of ourselves.
And have there been any actions taken in your short tenure in the position to help maintain the ethos of our own continuous improvement?
Yeah, you know, so something that the college is going through right now is we are working on improving the tying together of the teaching and the assessment and the curriculum process. You could think of them as like a triangle kind of thing. And we are trying to tie all of those three main things together so that what's going on in teaching helps to inform assessment. Assessment helps to inform teaching. Teaching helps to inform curriculum. Curriculum helps to inform assessment, and get this triumvirate kind of thing going that then at its heart helps to improve the quality of what we provide at the in the College of Business. And that's a really significant development, and we're taking strides and making moves with it each and every day.
My guest today has been Dr. Neil Meredith, Director of Continuous Improvement, Professor of Economics, and the Dana Professor of Business. I love our lengthy titles around here.
It's academia.
That's right. We need like 12-inch wide business cards. Assessing higher ed is certainly no small task, as you've heard about today, but it's part of our accountability to every constituent we have, from our students to our colleagues to our accreditors, even the taxpayers. Neil, thanks for being on the show again, and may everything that you and we do work together to make our courses and programs a little bit better each semester.
Thanks for having me, Nick.
You've been listening to Buff Speak from the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University. Our executive producer is Justin Lovell, and Allison Hunter is our associate producer. Our co-editors are Maverick Evans and Paul Torres. Lindsay Bjork is our director of marketing and outreach initiatives, which includes overseeing Buff Speak. Dr. Jeffrey Babb is director of accreditation and is our technical consultant. Finally, Dr. Amjad Abdulat is Dean of the College. You can find us online at wtamu.edu/COB for more information about our programs. Be sure to check out our many academic offerings. Come for the quality, stay for the small classes, affordable tuition, and friendly, approachable professors. And look online at our faculty blog, profspeak.com, for more insights. You can listen to Buff Speak on your favorite podcast portal, as well as on our website, buffspeak.biz. And if you like what you've been hearing, don't be afraid to share us with your friends, colleagues, and family. Word of mouth has always been the best form of advertising. Until next time, love one another. For the Paul and Virginia Engler College of Business at West Texas A&M University, I am Dr. Nick Gerlich. And as always, go Buffs! Buff Speak.